Hello, this is Todd Durakan with the Decatur Herald and Review for Tuesday, November 17th, 2020, coming to you from my home studio. And we start on the front page, Midwest Special Report, Part 2. Schools scramble. Approaches vary across Midwest as COVID sweeps region. This article is by Lee Enterprises. After overhauling operations to combat the spread of COVID-19, school districts across the virus-battered Midwest are scrambling to contain outbreaks, communicate with parents, and keep classrooms staffed as teachers are forced to quarantine. Some districts in Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana, and Minnesota started the year determined to continue in-person learning with a bevy of new protocols and precautions, only to return all students to online-only classes after a spike in cases. Others have temporarily shuttered schools or sent whole classes into isolation to prevent the virus spread. We are keenly aware of the burden this change puts on families, especially those with several children and adults working from home, said Sister Judith Schaefer, president of Cotter Schools in Winona, Minnesota, when announcing an abrupt return to remote learning last week. We all wish life were different right now. Journalists from Lee Enterprises Midwest last week sampled public school districts about policies and found widely different approaches and methods. In some areas, students have not stepped into a classroom since March, with all courses conducted through video chat and e-learning programs. Others adopted a hybrid approach with part-time classes that allow for more interactive lessons such as science labs. Many districts have already determined students will stay home through all of the winter holidays, anticipating more family gatherings that amplify the risk of outbreaks. People have get-togethers and go places over the holidays, said Larry Day, principal of St. Teresa High School. We want to give time for symptoms to show up so they're not in school and we don't have to do contact tracing. The constant changes, all rooted in a desire to keep students, staff, and family safe, have added tension to an already tumultuous time. The biggest impact on the district is we cannot get in a good groove on anything. We do not have the ability to plan for our future, said Daniel Booth, superintendent of Carbondale Elementary School District 95 in southern Illinois. It makes a job that is already tough even tougher. Yo-yo effect. In Wisconsin, the state's education agency this summer offered guidance for how schools could safely reopen. But the agency stopped short of telling the 421 districts what metrics should prompt a retreat from face-to-face learning. In rural areas, the vast majority of districts chose to begin the year fully in person, driven primarily by a lack of broadband access that limit options for remote learning, said Kim Kaukel, executive director of the Wisconsin Rural Schools Alliance. But since early September, temporary closures have become a near daily occurrence across south central Wisconsin. There's been a lot of yo-yoing going on, opening, closing, Kaukel said. With the dramatic surge in COVID-19 cases, more rural districts are switching to remote instruction through the end of November or until early December, hoping to get through the hot period, Kaukel said. But limited broadband access remains the biggest issue in rural areas, and some schools view an extended switch to online learning as a last resort, he said. In La Crosse, Wisconsin, 48% of district families are considered economically disadvantaged. The district provided mobile hotspots for those without internet and distributed meals from 30 locations to those 18 and younger. Administrators had hoped to return students to class in the fall but decided to maintain remote learning after a rapid spike in cases. These decisions are not easy, Superintendent Aaron Engel said. They keep you awake at night or with a sick feeling in your stomach. More than two dozen districts in northwest Indiana also rapidly changed plans last week in response to an increase in cases. Reopening strategies varied among the mix of urban, suburban, and rural communities, with some opting for fully remote or hybrid learning options before transitioning back to in-person learning in some districts just weeks ago. Now, with county positivity rates triple that of the start of the academic year, more communities are turning back to remote learning, some for just a couple of weeks to allow affected staff and students to finish quarantines, and others to wait out potential spread in the coming holiday season. In the Lake Central School Corp, one of the largest school districts in Northwest Indiana, students began the year with in-person learning. More than 1,400 students and staff were quarantined November 4th through 10th. As a result, the district will begin transitioning students to virtual learning next week, with officials hoping to return to in-person instruction in early December. At least a dozen other Northwest Indiana districts have made similar adjustments within the last 2 weeks, drawing concern for the increasing instability of students' education. One such decision this week in East Chicago, Indiana, drew the ire of teachers and paraprofessionals working for the city's public school system and its neighboring districts. The school city of East Chicago began the academic year virtually and had only transitioned back to in-person instruction for 2 weeks before administrators announced Monday they would shut buildings down again. Students are only expected to learn from home for about 2 weeks, bringing them back to buildings between Thanksgiving and winter breaks. "We need to close down and do this all online virtual," said Juanita Espinosa Guillen, an East Chicago paraprofessional, speaking at a rally from the steps of City Hall Thursday. "They're trying to do both. They're trying to do virtual and they're trying to do in class. And I feel bad because the students that are virtual aren't really getting the education they need. While officials in face-to-face districts say transmission of the virus between students in class remains low, the rapid rise in community spread outside of schools has administrators pleading with parents to do their part to keep students in school where educators say students learn best." Dr. Christina Box, Indiana's top health official, said community spread is rising as a result of pandemic fatigue, with adults refusing to wear masks, employers requiring staff to work through quarantine, and parents deciding not to test their children for fear they will have to quarantine. "I understand that this is hard," Box said. "This entire year has been hard, but it's going to get even harder if we don't recommit to those very basic mitigation procedures that we've been discussing all year: wearing a mask, socially distancing, staying home if you're sick, and getting tested and washing your hands." Rapid deterioration. In Winona, Minnesota, public school students have undergone several changes since the start of the year, when a hybrid approach was initially planned for all students. High school students switched to remote learning until late September. After a period of hybrid learning for all, a spike in cases last week caused the district to first announce that middle school classes and later all classes would switch back to remote learning. "The public health situation deteriorated much faster than we anticipated," Superintendent Annette Freiheit said in a letter to the community Thursday after 71 new cases were announced. "As much as we would have liked to give more advanced warning, we are concerned that we are exposing our students, staff, and their families to infection if we don't act now." For smaller schools, even a few positive cases can have an outsized effect. That's what happened to the 7th grade class at the Maroa Forsyth School District in Central Illinois. When two students tested positive there, it meant more than half of the grade had to be quarantined. Parent Jennifer Panganiban said she had been impressed with the handling of the situation. "Students can attend in person 4 days a week, with Wednesdays all remote for all students, or choose e-learning, which is a combination of live online sessions and students working independently. The communication has continued to be ongoing, clear, honest, and supportive from both the administration and teachers," she said. "The teachers are doing so much to support the kids and to help them know they are loved. I can't believe how much both of our kids have learned this year." Another rural Central Illinois district, Hayworth in McLean County, moved all students back to remote learning for the rest of the fall semester after the number of positive cases tripled in recent weeks. Superintendent Lisa Taylor said the district, with fewer than 1,000 students, reached a tipping point where they would likely have more students at home than in person with too few staff members to fill all positions. Honestly, it just felt like we would be doing a disservice to the district to keep it in person at this point, she said. Varying approaches. In Dane County, Wisconsin, which includes the state capital of Madison, public school systems opted for an online beginning to 2020 and 2021. Most of the public students in the county haven't seen the inside of a classroom since March. That includes the 26,000 student Madison School District, the state's second largest school system, which will stay online until at least January. It's a different story in the county's private schools. After planning for a return to face-to-face learning, private school leaders in Dane County were blindsided in August by the local health department's decision to restrict most grades to learning and online exclusively. Private schools, parents, and advocacy groups succeeded in getting the state Supreme Court to temporarily block those restrictions. While COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations are increasing, health department officials report they are supportive of bringing back face-to-face learning for pupils in kindergarten to second grade, as we are not seeing strong connections to in-person school environments. Even in contagious communities, approaches can vary greatly. The Kenosha Unified School District last week ignored a warning from its local health department that all schooling should be virtual through at least the end of 2020. Immediately to the north, Racine Unified School District has kept all students learning from home since March. The Kenosha School District, which includes 40 schools, said instead that it would follow its previously outlined plans for the year, a blueprint called Return 2020, that allows it to evaluate school buildings on a case-by-case basis. The school district has experienced several outbreaks, and in the first 2 weeks of the year, had to close 7 buildings to in-person learning. Since the start of school, we have addressed areas of high need while having little to no impact on other schools that have not been greatly impacted by COVID-positive cases, the district reported. This targeted approach, in conjunction with the following mitigation efforts, has helped to slow the spread within our schools. Racine's public health department, aggravated over some segments of the public ignoring masking and social distancing protocols, on Thursday ordered all of the schools in its jurisdiction, public and private, to close buildings after Thanksgiving. The top priority must be keeping students and staff safe until the pandemic is under control, said Angelina Cruz, president of the Racine Educators Union. Okay, there is a photo here that accompanies the article. Fifth grader Braden Brown heads to his parents' car after school on Friday at Warrensburg Latham Elementary School in central Illinois. Parents pick up students during staggered times. In another photo, a McLean County Unit District No. 5 school bus is operated by a driver wearing a mask on Friday. In the sidebar here, says Midwest Reporting, this is the second in a series of special reports by the Lee Enterprises Midwest reporting team on the developing impact of COVID-19 on the region. Visit our website for the first part, how hospitals are handling the surge, and come back for a look at COVID-19's effect on commerce throughout the Midwest. Decatur Government Council discusses mask ordinance. Tony Reed, Decatur. The Decatur City Council looked ready to follow Mayor Julie Moore-Wolf's lead and vote in a strict new ordinance Monday night that would require face masks to be worn outside the home and open scoff laws to fines from $50 to $500 if they don't comply. The issue was still being discussed late into the evening at Monday's council meeting, but a majority of council members appeared in favor after Wolf said the surging infection spread from COVID-19 warranted significant measures to try and stop it. The mayor said she sympathized with businesses like bars and restaurants that are, quote, getting killed, unquote, by state-mandated lockdown measures affecting how they operate, but she added, yes, they are being killed, but everybody is being hurt by this virus. We have to get our arms around this community and stop this virus. It's out of control. The ordinance, which would take immediately effect on passage, sets the fines for a first offense at $50 and gradually ramps them up to $500 for a fourth and each subsequent offense. The ordinance says masks must be worn by customers and staffs in any kind of shop or business, and including buses, taxis, ride-sharing, and picking up food to go in restaurant drive-through lanes. Wolf has said previously that she understands the strain of more stringent mask-wearing ordinance might impose on businesses already reeling from state-mandated bans on indoor bar and restaurant service. The mayor said she acknowledged the economic damage, but said stopping COVID-19 must be the city's number one priority. Several citizens spoke up on both sides of the issue, but most were against imposing a mask ordinance. Teresa Palmer, whose 23-year-old son Logan died in a Navy accident in 2017 while serving his country, told the council, "My son died for my right to take my mask off and not to have to live in some tyrannical-type society." But council members were generally on board with the idea that something had to be done, and Councilman David Horn said the mask ordinance was crucial. "Protecting the health and safety of our residents is our number one priority. And the consensus of both the scientific and healthcare community is that wearing masks saves lives." And yet, while the virus rages on and has also infected the city budget by driving down revenues, it now turns out the effects proved to be nowhere near as severe as initially feared. Macon County officials plea for schools and churches to go virtual. It's articles by Donette Beckett, Decatur. County health officials are asking schools and houses of worship to return to virtual-only classes and services until the middle of January to help ease the spread of the coronavirus. They made the plea during a Monday news conference. Macon County Health Department Administrator Brandy Binkley said a request was sent Monday morning to public school superintendents, setting January 15th as a suggested date to return to live instruction. "Do that as soon as possible," she said, "or at least by the Thanksgiving holiday." The announcement comes as the state and county face alarming increases in the number of coronavirus cases and deaths in the past month, and concerns that the upcoming holiday season and the family gatherings associated with it will cause the situation to worsen. "When it comes to family gatherings, this is the year to make sacrifices and think outside the box," Binkley said. Binkley used the virtual news conference to announce 158 more county residents have tested positive for the virus, bringing the county's total to 5,346 cases since the start of the pandemic in March. Of those, 3,514 have been released from isolation, 1,694 remain in home isolation, 89 have died, and 49 are hospitalized. The Macon County positivity rate is currently at 16.1%. "The target is 8%, so we are double that," Binkley said. "We are now hitting the surge that we expected last spring, that really didn't hit us. We are now being hit harder than we ever imagined," Decatur Moore Mayor Julie Moore Wolf said. Health officials are also encouraging bars and restaurants that are not compliant with the current recommendations to do so now. Macon County and the rest of the state are currently under state-imposed restriction that limits the size of gatherings and prohibit the indoor sale of food and beverage in restaurants and bars. However, many local businesses continue to do so. "We realize this has been a very large burden on everyone in our community," Binkley said. "We are asking you and begging you to do everything that you can to help save lives." Hospital officials who took part in the news conference expressed concern about the declining number of hospital beds because of the COVID-19 spike. According to Drew Early of Decatur Memorial Hospital, the hospitals are filling up with COVID patients. "The strain and stress that this is putting on organizations and most importantly our frontline and healthcare workers is very real," he said. "The volume is here. It's up to the public to help manage it." Officials also encourage people to take precautions, including social distancing, wearing a mask, and avoiding large gatherings. "We can do a little bit We can go a little bit deeper, said Michael Hicks, HSHS St. Mary's Hospital Administrator. It comes with the idea of triaging yourself. Those that need testing are encouraged to visit one of the testing facilities. We can't stop the virus, Hicks said, but we can slow it down. Drive-through testing resources are available daily in the Decatur Civic Center parking lot. Crossing Healthcare staff provides testing. The Illinois Department of Public Health will be taking over the service next week until December 20th. Crossing Healthcare will open another facility on their campus beginning December 1st. This will increase the testing capacity for our community and give us two locations, said Tanya Andrix, Crossing Healthcare CEO. Andrix discouraged large gatherings during the holidays. She also encouraged looking after loved ones and neighbors. Physical health and mental health are a concern at this time. With social distancing, with limiting the size of gatherings, can come fear and isolation, Andrix said. Resources and therapists are available for support, according to Andrix. Our healthcare resources in this community are finite, she said. You can do your part to check on your neighbors and oversee their mental health, but also yourself. Okay, that was all of the articles on page one. We move to page A3, local and state. Man faces attempted murder charges. This is by Tony Reed from Decatur. Warren D. Burnett is facing two preliminary charges of attempted murder after police say he helped pistol whip two men before dousing them with gasoline or lighter fluid and setting them on fire. The victims, ages 24 and 22, suffered terrible burns to their faces and upper bodies in the November 10th attack, according to a sworn affidavit from Decatur police. The younger man had to be intubated and was flown from Decatur Memorial Hospital to Memorial Medical Center in Springfield for more specialized treatment. He suffered severe burns to his face, lips, left eye, both hands, upper chest, and left thigh, according to the affidavit, and had complained of chest and throat and lung pain. The 24-year-old, with second-degree burns to his face, left hand, left forearm, and the left side of his body, also needed six staples to close a gaping wound in the back of his head, the affidavit said. When the men were well enough to speak days later, they provided information that led police to the scene of the assault, a house in the 700 block of West Wagoner Street, where Burnett, 25, was in residence and arrested Friday. A check of Macon County jail record showed that Burnett is free after posting $50,000 bond on bail set at $500,000. All preliminary charges are subject to review by the state attorney's office. Detective Brad Hall, writing in the affidavit, said Burnett had been identified by the victims as the man they knew as Duke, and he had been one of four men who had taken part in the pistol whipping and beating before Burnett doused the two victims and set them on fire. The older victim thought he had used gasoline. The younger victim said he believed it was lighter fluid, Hall said. Both men said they had gone to the house on the evening of November 10th after arranging to buy cannabis there, and the older victim said he had bought the drug from Burnett previously. Hall said the older victim said he had gone inside, leaving the other man in the car, and had been immediately robbed and attacked and was beaten unconscious. The younger man, waiting in the car outside, became concerned and after 20 minutes messaged Duke and asked what was going on. He said the two subjects exited the residence the other victim had gone into and dragged him out of the car at gunpoint, said Hall. The victim said he started fighting with the subjects because he thought they were going to shoot him. This younger victim said he was then beaten about the face and head with a gun before being hauled inside the house and thrown on the floor next to the older victim. He said when he first saw the older victim, he thought he was dead, added Hall. He stated after being thrown to the ground, the subject knew as Duke started spraying him and the other victim with lighter fluid. He said Duke then lit him and the other victim on fire. It took a couple of minutes, Hall said, but both victims described being able to beat the flames out as their assailants looked on, holding them at gunpoint. Both men then had pillowcases pulled over their heads and were marched back to their car, driven to another area, and told to get out. Hall said they heard another car driving away. When they pulled off the pillowcases, they found their vehicle was still there. They then got inside and drove themselves to Decatur Memorial Hospital despite their severe injuries. Seven residents file to run for council. Herald and Review, Decatur. There will be a race for Decatur City Council. Four individuals were on hand at 8 a.m. Monday morning when the Decatur City Clerk's office opened and began accepting candidate petitions to be on the April 6th ballot. There are three available seats. You know what they say, third time's a charm, said Marty Watkins, who is making his third run for council. Also filing Monday morning were Ed Culp and incumbents David Horn and Chuck Cooley. A lottery will be held to decide the order of appearance on the ballot. Filing later in the day were Adolphus Cooper, Elijah England, and William Will Wetzel. The seat currently held by Pat McDaniel also is up for grabs. McDaniel has announced he will not seek another term. Petitions are being accepted through Friday from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. and again from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday, November 23rd, in the office of the city clerk on the third floor of the Decatur Civic Center, 1 Gary K. Anderson Plaza. The April 6th ballot will also feature candidates for school, park, and community college boards, among others. The filing periods for those positions isn't until December. And the photo that accompanies this is taken by Scott Perry, Herald and Review. Marty Watkins left, Ed Culp, Chuck Cooley, and David Horn wait Monday morning for the Decatur City Clerk's office to open so they can file their petitions on the ballot for Decatur City Council. And they're all standing socially distanced apart waiting. Well, with all of the building and home projects going on during coronavirus, on the money page, page A5, there's an article here that says Home Depot reunites with HD Supply in deal valued at $8 billion. This article is by Michelle Chapman, Associated Press. Home Depot is reuniting with former subsidiary HD Supply, buying the company in a deal valued at about $8 billion. The acquisition will give Home Depot a stronger hand in the contractor and professional side of its business, which is booming during the pandemic, just like its more consumer-facing DIY sales. HD Supply is a distributor of maintenance, repair, and operations products in the multifamily and hospitality markets. Home Depot initially bought HD Supply in 1997, but sold it in 2007 when Home Depot began to focus more on its retail operations. Home Depot Chairman and CEO Craig Menear said in a prepared statement that the acquisition will give it access to HD Supply's extensive distribution network throughout the U.S. and Canada. A subsidiary of Home Depot, Inc. will pay $56 per share for HD Supply's common stock. Home Depot re-entered the $55 billion maintenance, repair, and operations market in 2015 when it spent $1.6 billion on Interline, now called the Home Depot Pro. That acquisition allowed Home Depot to expand its projects in the education and healthcare sectors, hospitality businesses, national multifamily apartment complexes, according to Jefferies analyst Jonathan Matuszewski. However, Home Depot only has a mid-single-digit percentage of the market, so the acquisition of HD Supply will help broaden its base of professional customers, Matuszewski wrote in a note to clients. The HD Supply acquisition is expected to close in the fourth quarter. Home Depot, based in Atlanta, reports quarterly earnings today. Shares rose 2% to $279.25 Monday. Well, that brings us to the end of the first half hour. We'll take a quick break and come right back with the Decatur Herald and Review for Tuesday, November 17th, 2020. Please stay tuned.